Chapter 13. The lumberjack's drawing of the wrecker paid off in 5 days. A sharp-eyed Southern Pacific ticket clerk in Sacramento recalled selling an Ogden, Utah ticket to a man who looked like the man that Don Albert had drawn. Even though his customer had a beard and his hair was almost as blonde as Isaac Bell's, there was something similar in the face, the clerk insisted. Bell interviewed him personally to ascertain that the clerk was not another fan of the great train robbery, and was impressed enough to order operatives to canvass the train crews on the Ogden Flyer. They hit pay dirt in Reno, Nevada. One of the Flyer's conductors, a resident of Reno, recalled the passenger too and agreed it could have been the man in the drawing, though he pointed out the difference in hair color. Bell raced to Nevada, ran him down at his home, and asked casually, as if only making conversation, whether the conductor had seen the great train robbery. He planned to, the conductor answered, the next time it showed at the Vaudeville House. His missus had been pestering him to take her for a year. From Reno, Bell caught an overnight express to Ogden and had dinner as the train climbed through the Trinity Mountains. He sent telegrams when it stopped at Lovelock and received several replies when it stopped at Imlay, and he finally fell asleep in a comfortable Pullman as it steamed across Nevada. The wires awaiting him at Montello, just before they crossed the Utah border, had nothing new to report. Nearing Ogden midday, the train sped across Great Salt Lake on the long redwood trestles of the Lucin Cutoff. Osgood Hennessy had spent $8 million and clear-cut miles of Oregon forest to build the new level route between Lucin and Ogden. It shortened the Sacramento-Ogden trip by 2 hours and dismayed Commodore Vanderbilt and J.P. Morgan, his rivals on the southern and northern routes. At the point where Bell was so close to the rail junction city that he could see the snow-capped peaks of the Wasatch Mountains to Ogden's east, his train ground to a halt. The tracks were blocked 6 miles ahead, the conductor told him. An explosion had derailed the westbound Sacramento Limited. Bell jumped to the ground and ran alongside the train to the front end. The engineer and fireman had dismounted from their locomotive and were standing on the ballast, rolling cigarettes. Bell showed them his Van Dorn identification and ordered, "Get me as close to the wreck as you can." "Sorry, Mr. Detective, I take my orders from the dispatcher." Bell's derringer appeared in his hand suddenly. 2 dark muzzles yawned at the engineer. "This is a matter of life and death, starting with yours," said Bell. He pointed at the cowcatcher on the front of the locomotive and said, "Move this train to the wreck and don't stop until you hit debris." "You wouldn't shoot a man in cold blood," said the fireman. "The hell he wouldn't," said the engineer, shifting his gaze nervously from the derringer to the expression on Isaac Bell's face. "Get up there and shovel coal." The locomotive, a big 462, steamed 6 miles before a brakeman with a red flag stopped them where the tracks disappeared in a large hole in the ballast. Just beyond the hole, 6 Pullmans, a baggage car, and a tender lay on their sides. Bell dismounted from the locomotive and strode through the wreckage. "How many hurt?" he asked the railroad official who was pointed out to him as the wreckmaster.
35. 4 seriously.
"Dead?"
"None. They were lucky. The bastard blew the rail a minute early. The engineer had time to reduce his speed."
"Strange," said Bell. "His attacks have always been so precisely timed."
"Well, this'll be his last. We got him."
"What? Where is he?"
"Sheriff caught him in Ogden.
Lucky for him. Passengers tried to lynch him.
He got away, but then one of them spotted him later, hiding in a stable."
Bell found a locomotive on the other side of the wreck to run him into Union Depot. The jailhouse was situated in Ogden's mansard-roofed city hall, a block from the railroad station. 2 top Van Dorn agents were there ahead of him, the older Weber and Fields duo of Mac Fulton and Wally Kisley. Neither was cracking jokes. In fact, both men looked glum.
"Where is he?" Bell demanded.
"It's not him," said Fulton wearily.
He seemed exhausted, Bell thought,
and for the first time he wondered if Max should be considering retirement. Always lean, his face was shrunken as a cadaver's.
Not who blew the train?
Oh, he blew the train, all right, said Kisley, whose trademark three-piece checkerboard suit was caked with dust. Wally looked as tired as Mac, but not ill.
Only he's not the wrecker.
Go ahead, you take a crack at him.
You'll have a better chance of getting him to talk. He sure as hell won't admit a word to us.
Why would he talk to me?
Old friend of yours, Fulton explained cryptically.
He and Kisley were both 20 years older than Bell, celebrated veterans and friends who were free to say whatever popped in their heads, even though Bell was boss of the Wrecker investigation.
I'd knock it out of him, said the sheriff. But your boy's said to wait for you, and the railroad company tells me Van Dorn calls the tune. Damn foolishness, in my opinion. But no one's asking my opinion.
Bell strode into the room where they had the prisoner manacled to a table affixed solidly to the stone floor. An old friend, to be sure, the prisoner was Jake Dunn, a safecracker. On the end of the table was a neat banded stack of crisp $5 bills, $500 worth, according to the sheriff, clearly payment for services rendered. Bell's first grim thought was that now the wrecker was hiring accomplices to do his murderous work for him, which means he could strike anywhere and be long gone before the strike happened.
Jake, what in blazes have you gotten mixed up in this time?
Hello, Mr. Bell. Haven't seen you since you sent me to San Quentin.
Bell sat quietly and looked him over. San Quentin had not been kind to the safecracker. He looked 20 years older, a hollow shell of the hard case he had been. His hands were shaking so hard it was difficult to imagine him setting a charge without detonating it accidentally. Relieved at first to see a familiar face, Dunn shriveled now under Bell's gaze.
Blowing Wells Fargo safes is robbery, Jake. Wrecking passenger trains is murder. The man who paid you that money has killed innocent people by the dozen.
I didn't know we were wrecking the train.
You didn't know that blowing the rails out from under a speeding train would cause a wreck?
Bell said in disbelief, his face dark with disgust.
What did you think would happen?
The prisoner hung his head.
Jake, what did you think would happen?
You gotta believe me, Mr. Bell.
He told me to blow the rail so the train would stop so they could hit the express car. I didn't know he was gonna put her on the ground.
What do you mean? You're the one who lit the fuse.
He switched fuses on me. I thought I was lighting a fast fuse that would detonate the charge in time for the train to stop. Instead, it burned slow.
I couldn't believe my eyes, Mr. Bell. It was burning so slow the train was going to run right over the charge. I tried to stop it.
Bell stared at him coldly.
That's how they caught me, Mr. Bell. I ran after it, trying to stomp it out. Too late. They saw me. And after she hit the ground, they lit out after me like I was the guy who shot McKinley.
Jake, you've got the hangman's rope around your neck and one way to get it loose. Take me to the man who paid you this money.
Jake Dunn shook his head violently. He looked, Bell thought, frantic as a wolf with a leg caught in a trap. But no, not a wolf. There was no raw power in him, no nobility. Truth be told, Dunn looked like a mongrel dog that had fallen for bait left for bigger game.
Where is he, Jake?
I don't know.
Why are you lying to me, Jake?
I didn't kill nobody.
You wrecked a train, Jake. You're damn lucky you didn't kill anybody. If they don't hang you, they'll put you in the penitentiary for the rest of your life.
I didn't kill nobody.
Bell changed tactics abruptly.
How'd you happen to get out of prison so soon, Jake? What did you serve, 3 years? Why'd they let you go?
Jake regarded Bell with eyes that were suddenly wide open and guileless.
I got the cancer.
Bell was taken aback. He had no truck with lawbreakers, but a killing disease reduced a criminal to just an ordinary man. Jake Dunn was no innocent, but he was quite suddenly a victim who would suffer pain and fear and despair. "I'm sorry, Jake. I didn't realize. I guess they figured to set me loose to die on my own. I needed the money. That's how I took this job." "Jake, you were always a craftsman, never a killer. Why are you covering for a killer?" Bell pressed. Jake answered in a hoarse whisper.
"He's in the livery stable on 24th, across the tracks."
Bell snapped his fingers. Wally, Kisley, and Mac Fulton rushed to his side. 24th Street, said Bell. "Livery stable. Cover it. Station the sheriff's deputies on the outer perimeter and wait for me." Jake looked up.
"He's not going anywhere, Mr. Bell."
"What do you mean?" "When I went back to get my second half of the money, I found him upstairs, in one of the rooms they rent out."
"Found him? What do you mean? Dead?" "Slit his throat. I was afraid to tell. They'd pin that on me, too."
"Slit his throat?" Bell demanded. "Or stabbed?" Jake ran a hand through his thinning hair.
"Stabbed, I guess."
"Did you see a knife?"
"No."
"Was he run through? Did the wound exit the back of his neck?"
"I didn't stick around to examine him close, Mr. Bell. Like I said, I knew they'd blame me."
"Get over there," Bell told Kisley and Fulton. "Sheriff, would you send a doctor? See if he can reckon what killed him and how long he's been dead."
"Where will you be, Isaac?"
Another dead end, thought Bell. The wrecker wasn't just lucky. He made his own luck.
"Railroad station," he answered without a lot of hope. "See if any ticket clerks recall selling him a ticket out of here."
He took copies of the lumberjack's drawing to Union Depot, a multi-gabled, two-story building with a tall clock tower, and queried the clerks. Then, driven in a Ford by a railway police official through tree-lined neighborhoods of cottages with jigsaw woodwork, he visited the homes of clerks and supervisors who were off work that day. Bell showed the drawing to each man, and when the man did not recognize the face, Bell showed him an altered version with a beard. No one recognized either face. How did the wrecker get out of Ogden? Bell wondered. The answer was easy. The city was served by 9 different railroads. Hundreds, if not thousands, of passengers passed through it every day. By now, the wrecker had to know that the Van Dorn agency was hunting him, which meant he would choose his targets more carefully when it came to preparing his escapes. Bell enlisted Van Dorn agents from the Ogden office to canvass hotels, on the odd chance that the wrecker had stayed in the Junction City. No front desk clerk recognized either drawing. At the Broom, an expensive 3-story brick hotel, the proprietor of the cigar store thought he might have served a customer who looked like the picture with the beard. A waitress in the ice cream parlor remembered a man who looked like the clean-shaven version. He had stuck in her mind because he was so handsome. But she had seen him only once, and that was 3 days ago. Kisley and Fulton caught up with Bell in the Spartan Van Dorn office, one large room on the wrong side of 25th Street, which was a wide boulevard divided by electric streetcar tracks. The side of the street that served the legitimate needs of railroad passengers using the station was lined with restaurants, tailors, barbers, soda fountains, ice cream parlors, and a Chinese laundry, each shaded by a colorful awning. Van Dorn's side housed saloons, rooming houses, gambling casinos, and hotels fronting for brothels. The office had a bare floor, ancient furniture, and a single window. Decoration consisted of wanted posters, the newest being the 2 freshly printed versions of the lumberjack's drawing of the wrecker, with and without the beard, noted by the sharp-eyed Southern Pacific ticket clerk in Sacramento. Kisley and Fulton had regained their spirits, though Fulton appeared exhausted. "Clearly," Wally remarked,
The boss doesn't waste money on office space in Ogden. Or furnishings, Mac added. That desk looks like it arrived by wagon train. Perhaps it's the neighborhood that appeals, located within spitting distance of Union Depot. And spitting they are, on our sidewalk. Continuing in Weber and Fields' mode, they went to the window and pointed down at the crowded sidewalk. Perceive Mr. Van Dorn's genius. The view from this window can be used to instruct apprentice detectives in the nature of crime in all its varieties. Come here, young Isaac. Gaze down upon our neighboring saloons, brothels, and opium dens. Observe potential customers down on their luck earning the price of a drink or a woman by panhandling. Or failing to kindle charity, sticking up citizens in that alley. Note there, a mustachioed fop luring the gullible with shell games on a folding table. And look at those out-of-work hard rock miners dressed in rags, pretending to sleep on the pavement outside that saloon while actually laying in wait for drunks to roll. How long was the man dead? Bell asked. Better part of a day, Doc thinks. You were right about the stabbing. A narrow blade straight through his neck. Just like Wish and the Glendale Yard Bull. So if the wrecker killed him, he could not have left Ogden before last night. But no one saw him buy a ticket. Plenty of freights in and out, ventured Wally. He is covering mighty long distances in a short time to rely on stealing rides on freights, said Mac. Probably using both, depending on his situation, said Wally. Bell asked, who was the murdered man? Local owl hoot, according to the sheriff. Sort of a real-life Bronco Billy, our chief suspect. Sorry, Isaac, couldn't resist. Fulton nodded at the wanted poster. Keep it up, and I won't resist asking Mr. Van Dorn to post Weber and Fields to Alaska. Suspected of knocking over a stagecoach up in the mountains last August. The Cinder Dicks caught him robbing a copper mine payroll off the Utah and Northern 10 years ago. Turned in his partners for a lighter sentence. Looks like he knew Jake Dunn from prison. Bell shook his head in disgust. The wrecker is not only hiring hands to help, but hiring criminals to hire help. He can hit anywhere on the continent. There was a tentative knock at the door. The detectives looked up, gazes narrowing at the sight of a nervous-looking youth in a wrinkled sack suit. He had a cheap suitcase in one hand and his hat in the other. Mr. Bell, sir? Isaac Bell recognized young James Dashwood from the San Francisco office, the apprentice detective who had done such a thorough job establishing the innocence of the Union man killed in the Coastline Limited wreck. Come on in, James. Meet Weber and Fields, the oldest detectives in America. Hello, Mr. Weber. Hello, Mr. Fields. I'm Weber, said Mac. He's Fields. Sorry, sir. Bell asked, what are you doing here, James? Mr. Bronson sent me with this, sir. He told me to ride expresses to beat the mail. The apprentice handed Bell a brown paper envelope. Inside was a second envelope addressed to him in penciled block letters, care of the San Francisco office. Bronson had clipped a note to it. Opened this rather than wait. Glad I did. Looks like he made you. Bell opened the envelope addressed to him. From it he withdrew the front cover of a recent Harper's Weekly magazine. A cartoon by William Allen Rogers depicted Osgood Hennessy in a tycoon's silk top hat astride a locomotive marked Southern Pacific Railroad. Hennessy was pulling a train labeled Central Railroad of New Jersey into New York City. The train was drawn to look like a writhing octopus. Hand-lettered in black pencil across the cartoon was the question, can the long arm of the wrecker reach farther than Osgood's tentacle? What the heck is that? Asked Wally. A gauntlet, answered Bell. He's challenging us. And rubbing our noses in it, said Mac. Mac's right, said Wally. I wouldn't cloud my head taking it personal, Isaac. The magazine is in there, too, said Dashwood. Mr. Bronson thought you'd want to read it, Mr. Bell. Seething inwardly, Bell quickly scanned the essence of the first page. Harper's, dubbing itself a Journal of Civilization, was reporting avidly the depredations of the railroad monopolies. This issue devoted an article to Osgood Hennessy's ambitions. Hennessy, it seemed, had secretly acquired a near-dominating interest in the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. The B&O already held, jointly with the Illinois Central, in which Hennessy had a large interest, a dominating interest in the Reading Railroad Company. The Reading controlled the Central Railroad of New Jersey, which gave Hennessy entry into the coveted New York district.
"What does it mean?" asked James.
"It means," explained a grim Isaac Bell, "that the Wrecker can attack Hennessy's interests directly in New York City." "Any train wreck he causes in New York," said Mac Fulton, "will hit the Southern Pacific even harder than an attack in California."
"New York," said Wally Kisley, "being the biggest city in the country."
Bell looked at his watch. "I've got time to catch the Overland Limited. Send my bags after me to the Yale Club of New York City." He headed for the door, firing orders. "Wire Archie Abbott. Tell him to meet me in New York. And wire Irv Arlen and tell him to cover the rail yards in Jersey City. And Eddie Edwards, too. He knows those yards. He broke up the lava bed gang that was doing express car jobs on the piers. You two finish up here. Make sure he's not still in Ogden, which I doubt, and find which way he went." "New York is, according to this," Wally said, holding up the Harper's Weekly and quoting from the article, "the holy land to which all railroaders long to make a pilgrimage."
"Which means," said his partner, "he's on his way already and will be waiting for you when you get there."
Halfway out the door, Bell looked back at Dashwood, who was watching eagerly. "James, do something for me."
"Yes, sir."
"You've read the reports on the wreck of the Coastline Limited?"
"Yes, sir."
"Tell Mr. Bronson I'm sending you to Los Angeles. I want you to find the blacksmith or machinist who drilled a hole in that hook that derailed the Limited. Can you do that for me?" "What's the matter?"
"But Mr. Sanders is in charge of Los Angeles, and he might..."
"Stay out of Sanders's way. You're on your own. Catch the next flyer west. On the jump." Dashwood ran past Bell and thundered down the wooden stairs like a boy let out of school.
"What's a kid going to do on his own?" asked Wally.
"He's a crackerjack," said Bell, "and he can't do worse than Sanders has so far." "Okay, I'm on my way. Mac, get some rest. You look beat."
"You'd look beat, too, if you'd been sleeping sitting up on trains for the last week."
"Let me remind you geezers to watch your step. The Wrecker is poison."
"Thank you for your wise advice, Sonny," answered Wally.
"We'll try real hard to remember it," said Mac. "But like I said, even money, he's already on his way to New York." Wally Kisley went to the window and watched Isaac Bell run to catch the Overland Limited.
"Oh, this'll be fun. Our hard rock miners ran out of drunks."
He motioned for Mac to join him at the window. Springing suddenly from the sidewalk, the hard rock miners swooped from both sides to ambush the well-groomed dude running for his train in an expensive suit. Neither stopping or even slowing, Bell cut through them like a one-man flying wedge, and the miners returned to the sidewalk face down.
"Did you see that?" Kisley asked.
"Nope, and neither did they." They stayed at the window, observing closely the citizens swarming about the sidewalk.
"That kid Dashwood?" Fulton asked.
"Remind you of anybody?"
"Who? Isaac?"
"No. 15... what am I saying? 20 years ago, Isaac was still chasing lacrosse balls at that fancy prep school his old man sent him to.
You and me, we was in Chicago. You were investigating certain parties engineering the cornering grain. I was up to my ears in the Haymarket bombing when we figured out the cops did most of the killing. Remember, this slum kid showed up looking for work?
Mr. Van Dorn took a shine to him, had you and me show him the ropes. He was a natural. Sharp, quick, ice water in his veins.
Son of a gun, said Mac.
Wish Clark. Let's hope Dashwood teetotals.
Look! Mac leaned close to the glass.
I see him, said Wally. He ripped the lumberjack's drawing off the wall, the picture with the beard added, and brought it to the window. A tall, bearded workman dressed in overalls and derby, who had been striding toward the railroad station, carrying a large tool sack over his shoulder, had been forced to stop in front of a saloon to allow two bartenders to throw four drunks to the sidewalk. Hemmed in by the cheering crowd, the tall man was glancing around impatiently, raising his face out of the shadow of his derby. The detectives looked at the drawing.
Is that him?
Could be. But it looks like he's had that beard a while.
Unless it's rented.
If it is, it's a good one, said Mac. I don't like the ears, either. They're nowhere near this big.
If it's not him, Wally insisted, it could be his brother.
Why don't we ask him if he has a brother?